A rock star in a smock. So just a quick announcement. I try to do a poetry discussion group valiantly every Monday at 8 o'clock. I show up and I bring poems with me that we can read and talk about. So if you want to ever show up any Monday at 8 o'clock, I'm here talking to myself. Maybe enjoying to read somebody's poem. I try to bring a combination of classic poets and modern poets, because I think it's the best way to learn about writing poetry. So the first poem I'm going to read is by one of my favorite modern poets, Marie Burns. This is not my poet, my poem. It was my poet, Marie Burns. And she wrote this brilliant poem called Walking Past the Domestic Science Room. The empty school flooded with the smell of new baking. My eyes on the polished parquet, my scuffed indoor shoes, my mind concentrating on tendrils of steam separating below the white ceiling inside the sycophant room, where boarders, big girls from the country, stand chatting, waiting for tins to cool, then breaking the sweet yellow cake in their hands. At my back, way back, red votive lights, dim subversion. The doors of the classrooms swing open on sunshine. The corridors unfurl, and everywhere the aroma, so strangely like home, but larger, stronger. The other thing is on the front page of ovls.ie. There's a link to, I've been trying to interview most of the guest poets who come here about their writing process, and they've given like a gold mine of information of what they do. So if you click on guest poet interviews, it goes to the comments page, and there's all sorts of really cool people who have given their time to us. So this is the website and reading interviews for who? Oh. Right, I'll take you one more. This is my own, called Changeability. He says perfect, noxious drops of his grievances, and they hang around in clouds. They're gravid, hanging daily over chores. Daily chores, like going to the shop for bread, like driving children home. This is how rain works. Your sins are at maximum capacity, and their collective body gives, shooting down gray blankets, making veils of your clinging hair, testing the integrity of skin as an organ of protection. You can dry off, but you won't warm, no matter how many fires you speak your name to, because this is a skeletal cold, a core structure shivering after this unprovoked baptism.
Thanks. Next up we have Nicole Le Febre. Le Febre.
Hi. I told my friends in the back I'd read one liner, and then I'm going to go on to something a little bit longer, but not too long. So the one line. Truth be told, we can't make love because you smoke cigarettes. And then this other one I have is kind of roughly inspired by Emily Dickinson's We Like March, We Choose Our Purple. So it's called Requiem 1901. It's moths were purple, they never too whole. In Mama Evie's house could smell of cinnamon candles instead of those deceptive white spheres. Mothballs appear so safe and so sweet as they save woolen clothes from greedy gray mouths. Graham's rosy frock waited a century before emerging from the attic, knowing it would disintegrate if any attempted to dress her cadaver. Yet, it wouldn't shine like the silver paint on my fingertips after pinching the life from a star of moth's wings.
Thank you. Mexico. Next up we have Mr. Matthew Sweeney.
New poem. Study in Yellow with Poodle, Paris, August 2008. This is a poem in two parts. Part one, Montmartre. In Montmartre, I gave up eating chicken legs. While a white-faced clown with a red carnation lured tourists into photographs with him, as riders from the Tour de France whizzed by, carrying their bikes up steep flights of steps, then careering down the next flight. I took refuge for 10 minutes in Sacré-Cœur, passing the howled-out progress of the tour. I resisted the urge to buy 10 euro novenas, despite the fact Pope Benedict would be coming, and en route to his real destination, Lourdes. I escaped through the flashbulbs of Japanese to witness two toddlers tormenting pigeons. Then I met a poodle on a lead, and three tiny shaved dogs of various breeds, each one making me want more, a kangaroo rat on a red lead, hopping delicately after me, while I whistled waits as Tom Trowbridge blues. Waltz in Matilda. Pausing at Renoir's Le Moulin de la Galette, I carried on down as far as Rue Le Pic to hide out in a wine bar with a bottle of Bandol, where a loquacious Frenchman put me on his mobile to talk to a friend in Dingle who asked if I was enjoying Paris. I thought of the cyclists on the steps, one of whom now would be king of Paris. I raised my glass as Bandol to him. I imagined myself in a yellow balloon rising above the hill of Montmartre, dropping apricots and mirabelles on the crowds below. To Pechamont. Pechamont is the best wine from the Dordogne, and impossible to find in Paris. One stained glass window high up in San Severin showed a bearded monk holding onto a large yellow X, as if we all should look for one. At the time I was on my own quest, seeking a wine I'd loved a decade ago in the Dordogne, the flagship Bergerac Red, known as Pechamont. I recalled lugging back to London a case of it, a nailed wooden box I named the Coffin, that I dipped into for a couple of years. Yet now, in Paris, the wine wasn't here. For days I'd called into Cab Avant, asking the embarrassing question, but no one knew the wine. One opined it was a vintage without reputation. This ensured I'd have to find it. I pulled on a canary yellow shirt with purple buttons, remembering a friend urging me to walk down Rue Mouffetard, a long street I found of constant eating. I passed several people with white poodles. I knew I'd find the Pechamont there, and I did, and the label was yellow.
Next up we have Mary O'Sullivan.
Hello. I'm just going to read two very quick poems. I don't have titles on them, so. As I gaze across the tempestuous horizon, one phrase springs to mind. My God, I'm free at last. With a warm wind whipping over me, drying my tears of joy. My God, I am free at last. With that, a skipped heartbeat, looking onwards, upwards, awaiting what yet another day will bring. the mystery of the unknown forever more alluring than the comfort of home. My God, I am free at last. With that thought, spirits buoyed, I rise and walk, each step leading me to a new destiny on a new path. Life moves at an unrelentless pace, no fast forward or rewind. No money or power in the world can bring it to a standstill, however hard they try. The basic rights of people are torn from them. Even when the mind moves them on, the body cannot assist. Sometimes it is easier to let go. No matter how stubborn the soul, we must continue. Clocks tick, time moves, never ending, never stopping.
Thanks, Mary. And next up we have Bree Budgie.
On the hill, in the forest, in the book, that the two Rapunzels. What did they look like? It was a tall tower? Yes, okay, no need to be impatient. One sits at the window, combing her river of yellow hair for gold. She is making mournful faces with the prettiest of sighs. The second features are carved from sighs black at night. She considers herself a bit of a Shakespeare sister, but all she seems to tap out on her typewriter these days is once upon a time, once upon a time, once upon a time. Angry though not openly that her sister always gets the main parts in her puppet plays. How unfair that Rosaline was cast away by Romeo. After all, Juliet was Rosaline who brought the garbs of poetry and played innocence. Did Romeo and Juliet have anything in common? Who knows? It was love at first sight. Had they lived, perhaps they had learned if they liked the same breakfast or could make each other laugh with a glance. We do know, however, that they both liked a good story. Yellow Rapunzel let down her hair. In the tower, on the hill, in the forest, in the books, the two Rapunzels. They must be lonely up there. Who do they have for company? Why, they have each other, of course. And when they're not looking, the witch watches to make sure they're still inside. Yellow Rapunzel has her white knight. Only he and his white unicorn said are a little late today, and yesterday, and yesterday, and yesterday. Still, she'll sit at the window and wait for him. Sometimes she lets down her hair only to find it isn't him, realizes on return her locks a little shorter. Black Rapunzel has a friend too, his name is Muffo Silken, but she hasn't figured that out yet, so don't tell her. She's sure she will soon, and when she does, everything will be okay. After all, a problem named is a ghost that's been exercised. Till then, she has the prophetic spinster, Heathcliff's secret lover, and the girl in black in the tower with her. Yellow Rapunzel lets down her hair. In the tower, on the hill, in the forest, in the books, with the two Rapunzels. What are they doing today? Well, Yellow Rapunzel is at the window, combing a river of hair for gold. Black Rapunzel is wound up about having no fun in her hair of night and ink, but will never mention it. Rumpelstiltskin sure has her busy today, weaving gold from straw. When back turns, sister steals smooth gold from the wheel, weaving in her hair. Black Rapunzel has typed a thousand names, but none sound just right. But she will not lose confidence, and when she finds it, she will walk out the door on her own two feet, though it's a long way down to the real world. She will someday, there's no two ways about it. Clack, clack, clack. She types, they all lived happily ever after, Rumpelstiltskin, but the page said once upon a time. Rumpelstiltskin laughs and tells his riddles, and Yellow Rapunzel left down her hair.
Thanks, Bree. And next up, we have Shannon Harrington.
Thanks, Bob. She dons her Bacardi and Coke and catches the eye of that bloke. Come follow me, not waving my feet. We're just going outside for a smoke. pilgrim soul. I wait slowly, eavesdropping on the faint creak of the outer helm, the wind in the rigging now more plaintive, feeling the pitch more adamant, a quiet gush from the air heater fan, the heel on the same tack more manifest, sensing the steeper roll. In my mind's eye, I see that huge wheel, unmanned, twitching, the mast headlight flashing a zigzag arc through the Milky Way like a white star on a yo-yo. I picture the skipper as he cajoles the indifferent face of the chart plotter neath to reveal a stream of cartographic data from a galaxy of satellites neath to explode in a myriad of coloured pixels. Then it dawns on me, no engine, no more motor sailing. It was the silence that woke me. I roll further downhill in cosy luxury, my ear an inch from the soporific gurgle as the ocean sluices past our hull, the moon's hidden pull on the tide adding 3 knots to our speed. 2 more hours of bliss left on watch below before the time to rise again. It is 1:50 a.m. Easter Sunday. The waiting room. I pace up and down, ignore the vacant seats. The window pulls me back to view the entrailing pipes and blips that raster on and on. Floating the clipboard, a white coat hurries by. Hard drives must be ready and ripe to flake out another blizzard of paper. Mr. Timford, a neutral voice at the doorway. That's me, an old gent drops his tabloid list to race from the seat. There is a problem. The anteroom door swings to and they're out of earshot. My thumping ribcage knows I must be next. Air, onto this bench. Ease the window catch. A feathery snowfall. Drooling on metallic roofs. Not an SUV in sight. A wailing ambulance. A commando spider drops down his bungee line. Someone is calling my name. I step out. She's 10 years old, for God's sake. Damn this NCT. This is an old one. And it's the first time to read it this month. Blind Harbor. Still dragging her anchor half cable closer. The deep-laden freighter on this coast a stranger, off blunt head and shoulder, drawing that extra meter, lacks the room to enter the mouth of Blind Harbor. But shrieking with laughter, sly wreckers that Easter, ignore pleading father, race past me, his verger, surviving narrator. Young fog growled the skipper, first sense the equator. He grabs his sou'wester from hitting white anger, greased under our counter, soon feeling our rudder. I swear by my father. As day breaks, waves miter, at poop deck they muster, their courage won't falter, expecting no quarter from each shameless vulture. Invoke Neptune's daughter, stave off that grim reaper. At flotsam high water, mean hearts pounding faster, a guide readies her hamper. And high on the danger, cliff scaling rope ladder, where many a coaster, dehound the fleet clipper, and that telling drifter known as Ocean Venture, each wild to a splinter, like fruits of their cooper, misled by a traitor, like lambs to the slaughter. Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus. Next up, trying something new, is Patricia Walsh.
Thank you, Paul. It's been very brief.
Well, I'm doing a demo. It's really important, first of all, and after that, just do a brief chapter from the forthcoming novel called The Quest for Lost Era. It's basically what it is. It's a story about something and trials and tribulations of some archaeologists and some obscure town called Bali III. So his poem, The Kiss. How the horizon has broadened when you set your song on my page. I see a mustard spraying through my mouth, and of sharper than open leaves. Catching as I fall, I find home in a whirligig. Once finished, I feel that I and the event are ready to recommend. Thank you. The Quest for Lost Era. Nobody could understand how something like this could happen. The future of the new archaeological company is promising, having a pedigree of the companies of archaeological research limited and site excavation also limited behind it. There is limited job there as well, because system limited ability, limited pay, payments, limited pay. Nevertheless, it has direct benefit of being backed with the creation money and creative consultancy. It was not long, however, before problems set in. The first problem in compounds where the company was based, namely their appliance, the show drawing company director's office. This was a situation that was needed like a migraine cross sufferer. He needed threatening. He came out of his office, looking around and putting on his eyes. It was a silencing painted. He flew immediately into a homicidal rage, grabbing the painter by the sculpted neck. "Run, Mr. Tourette, what the hell is this?" He pointed aside the van. The acronym of the company spelling out as clear as day, A-R-S-E. "Well, Mr. Tourette," having wrecked himself in his grip, "we totally brought this in the van, so what the hell more do you want? This is a bloody joke, but we can't afford you to produce it all again. We just have to leave things there." He threw up his hands in frustration. God, you couldn't have scripted this. The Hagerty twins, John and Paul, were what was known in the business as amateur students, in the sense that they had finally gone to college after being sacked from every bad job there was. Although they were diligent students, they were more involved in the sophisticizing in the college bar than scribbling away in the library. Their lives studies in archaeology served them well, however, when, while walking in the country, they recovered miracles on sites that existed in the ones that imaginations of their own. Every time they walked past a stone wall, the child suddenly looked from wood of stones, or when walking in the woods for copper trees. Nor could it have ruined castle well on the side west as the cruel hand in history dealt with these structures, where there was Cromwell under that intent. They convinced anyone that the Emperor's new clothes were not just a PR exercise. So it should come as no surprise that an archaeological company should go out looking for this into repair at some point, especially since the twins had sent CVs to every archaeological company going. Paul had just gone out of the show when his phone rang. His timing could not have been better as he was down to try to use a chair. "Hello? Is this the Higgins twins?" "One of." "Who's calling?" "This is Miriam from Archaeological Research and Site Excavation." "You mean R?" "Yes," she said defensively. "Yes, we know. We have a job for you two who are interested." "Yeah, where?" "We are excavating by the third ahead of new bypass on Route 666. "You know where it is?" "Yeah, where at one point it was seen as mass grave by Cromwell in the 17th century and that there was a ruined castle there." "Don't know where is it exactly. As I said, you take Route 666 or South Blacktown and find the first turn right above the village. I want to find the old nighttime cheese factory. So you have your own transport." Paul had mentioned that his twin sold a car earlier here in order to take these. He has a trusted and red Toyota Starlet that was bought off several carefully the owners, namely a group in his own car they gave the convent. He never missed that in the vehicle as much as at that moment. So he answered, "No." "Well," she continued, "we can arrange a lift with Joanne and Sarah. The going up from the city as a morning would have a seven. Thanks, is there anything I need? All you really need is a boy as good as Pony Joe. And for God's sake, don't bring one no bigger than 4 inches. One of us got an 8-inch Charlie to Joe and he's paid the first day. Are you serious? Yes, sir, that be still. I thought he needed a moment, he gets driving to a theatre. But he gets someone to help with all features. There's pregnant pause. So will you usually take a job? We may have to work in terms of separate sites, although I hate separating twins. Yes. All right then, I should know that the director is getting global. See you Monday. Yeah, see you then. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tisha.
Brilliant.
Next up we have Mom Harriet.
This is four little cameos in verse. Out of the mouths of kids. I'll do this for a quotation mark. After sitting through a Chaplin film, I'm still in a silent monochrome haze. Granny, how did you keep up with people in those fast walking days? Next one. Dad, I just saw a huge dinosaur down at the end of the lane.
I did.
Kidderlink adults came down with the last shower of rain. And the next one. In the name of the Father and the Son and in the hole he goes. That's the name of the dead robin. No nonsense practicality, that shows. Next one, last one. Quotation. Didn't you like the shepherd's pie? And a quotation. Next quotation. Well, I really like the pie bit. Why not eat the rest then? You don't have the shepherd in it.
Next up we have Eugene Crowley.
Close winter, half dark, half foggy. We leave the station for the estate woods and meadows. A trolley full of logs in the hall. A drowning man in one of the pictures. Bedside reading. Inviting reading. Tea in the library. Conversation circles. Fight closing time. And the offer of a lift by Richard Wood to the station. Once summer camping with the cub. First encounter with Coca-Cola machine. First taste of oranges.
Next up we have Dean Cody.
Hello. I spent the last few years living in New Orleans, Louisiana and Louisville, Kentucky. And in New Orleans, I tend to have a lot of interesting encounters with interesting people. So this is one of them. She squatted down on a slate and stoop and let her polished bones tumble and clack from her little skin bag around her calloused toes. The azure and gold in her eyes matched the hues of the iguana coat, so perfectly it thought of her and it as one, a reptile beauty reading bones. Her fingers seized the sallow runes, and some unseen ghost made a breath catch within her throat, a sound she tried not to expose. Nervously she scooped the baleful little oracles into her vellum runes, and a smile so pained those vivid eyes lit on purple from the bruise. She pecked my cheek, smelling of Evangeline, and wordless walked along. I wish I told her that I wanted her to read my not so brittle bones. Okay.
Thanks, Dean. Next up we have Patrick Hutter.
Oh, hey!
I'm going to read two poems, one by myself and one by Raska. Both make reference to whiskey. My own makes reference to eating chicken. I've heard this poem tonight. Too late for Cap Quinn chicken processing factory, which closed today after 40 years. Now, my own poem I wrote 21 years ago and first published 18 years ago, so I got documentary proof that it was published. Written that long ago, and it's extremely important that you make note of the fact that I wrote this poem 21 years ago. Not because I want to make any special plea for prodigyhood, but because if I'd written this poem today, yesterday, or even 10 years ago, it would constitute an act of criminality. It's part of a sequence of poems set in Dusseldorf in 1980. Portrait of a Young American Girl, Dusseldorf. 1987. Remember sitting comfy on the ground of the crowded, cobbled Altstadt street. The roasting fowl on Heine's spits found favor with our noses, which moved our feet to hasten us to ask for one whole sacred bird. That chicken's tang still lingers on my tongue as I recall a later time, same place, a third chick settled herself down and wrung her arms around me like a flourish weed swirling the bowl of a clapped out oak. A drunken mouth, albino, full of greed, sipped quietly between her teeth. Not coke, but malt whiskey, vintage, seat in peat. The cooling breeze erected, neglected heat. That afternoon, nasty youths with shaven heads, fingers behind ears to resemble fool's crowns, didn't quite goose-step, or hop, or cluck, but spread their limbs awkwardly in some drunken strut. Frowns had no effect on their comportment. No Turks or Greeks about, they jeered at us who shared whiskey with a mouse. We were arsehole fucking Jew cock sucking non-Aryan freaks. Her naked belly button became more rhythmic to arouse those fascist pricks. To advertise what they couldn't touch, nor could I. She gave me more to drink, but not from the same chalice the rodent drank. No such high schoolish luck. She was about 16, I think. Her hair was corn-colored, her eyes were green. My drunken attraction for her was, I know, obscene. In a mirror, her eyes had known no wrinkles. Only in a lover's face, her favorite quickly. Her name for aging sugar daddies whose eyes see six of kissful honey where we see ankles mean. She tells me, to him my tiny teeth are gobstoppers. His real name's Herbert. My irises are bullseyes. My bodily dirt is sweetest sherbet. And then from Reska, my passive waltz. The whiskey on your breast could make a small boy dizzy, but I hung on like death, such waltzing was not easy. We romped until the pans slid from the kitchen shelf. My mother's countenance could not unfrown itself. The hand that held my wrist was battered on one knuckle. At every step you missed, my right ear scraped a buckle. You beat time on my head with a palm caked hard by dirt, then waltzed me off to bed, still clinging to your shirt.
I don't know if you know a town called Ballincollig. Ballincollig, changing for the better. The Bank of Scotland adverts like tablets from God announced to us all. The change is good for them, perhaps. I'm not too sure about the willow tree wasted to the hill hotel or the deadly fumes on the road dividing the village, now becoming a town where banks own it. The ice melted when we crossed to this land with dense forests and lush waters. Life was good when we sang of forest and sea for an age and eternity. People waves came from across the ocean with horses and iron and Celtic tongues. They too passed away and different people in days with their weapons and noses. Someday they too will be ghosts like us, the beaker people, who just left our beakers lying around and didn't seem to bother much with smelters and stone circles. Faring said, sing our love at forest and sea for an age and a turn.
Thanks, Barbara. Next up we have Brian McElroy.
Hello. This poem is called Failure. As I acclimatize to my new environment, I stay some visitors for a couple of months. My mind settles, my heart opens, and I realize the universe's possibilities that each heartbeat of life represents, and I lament the wasted moments, wasted in misery. Oh, I'm such a hopeless poet, the best type, after all. What is failure? And the next one is called My Mommy. I love my mommy. She makes me yummy food. I eat it with my friends by the river. Thanks, mommy.
Sean?
Yeah?
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Next up to the open mic, we have Joe Harding.
I think Paul should be given a perfect heart to a comment. When we sold our mother's house, we had to throw letters and she was very well known, Cork and all that. Anyway, it's called Your Letters. I threw your life away just now, your best friend, soulmate. I know tears left your cheeks and fell on pages, but how did they love you? Who were they? We thought it was us alone who were there, but we were gone when the maid came your way. Our love seldom came in words, was furrowed out along a single track without a tributary or crack. Shallow flows those rivulets and uncarred. But should I by mere letters feel cowed, knowing the loving river always flows? That's it. About time as well, in my youth. In my youth I tested time and time won, unknowing testing was my only crime. Then there was so much doing to be done. No one said, someday there will be no sun. The day will come for you to relish time. In my youth I tested time and time won. Now I know someone should have held a gun to my head, saying you should check the rhyme, then there was so much doing to be done. I thought that she was safe for me alone, for furious seconds that sped sublime. I tested time in my youth and time won. As all minutes weigh me down as a ton, I rise to watch the bloody sun's first climb. now there's some doing to be done. And all the evening spent at that of time, while my thinning blood slowly turns to slime, I kept the time in my youth and time won. Then there was so much doing to be done.
Thank you, Donald. Next up we have Kate McGrew.
Don't think I'm pretty and be polite. Tell me, who sits down slope from where I stand, high and alone, hair aflame and mouth full of the night sky? 'Cause I think she sits, sober and taking note. No scholar, yet sharp. Death circling, stuffed with hope. Come, crack my pot. Let me shudder in gladness to ripple with nature's intention. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Next up we have Brian Aramoku. Yeah? Here? Anyway.
The sun is scribbled in the sky so that dogs like me can lie around and abound in what it feels like to be a hot and spiritual arm. Sound, no sound. I play not with the poetry of problems. I make no match with and or of the meaning of life. Love, ecstasy, bliss, I am. Simply this. So what the dog to think of all those human doings that lie in the scribble of the sun, but no rest mind can give, tangled in thought on the meaning of life, where the only meaning of life is to live. When your hair is in knots and crosses the ocean to take fight for presence, when your mind is in ecstasy and owes more money than your winnings in bread, no, that there's a hippie that loves you from toe to head.
Is there a hippie in the house? Next up, haven't seen an eye, just Alan Fisher.
Okay, just to add a bit of seriousness to the situation. I'm not sure if I've read this before, it's one of my stories. If I have, apologies, but if not, sure it's worth listening to again. There's only, I think it's 121 days left of Christmas, I thought I'd read the story. It's not a shopping day, you know. And it's not about poultry. It's called Jesus Wept, and I can read two Christmas stories or two biblical stories if you wish, but we'll see how this one goes first. Jesus Wept. And it came to pass in those days that Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea to Mary and to Joseph the woodworker. And after he was born, she placed him in swaddling clothes because it was cold, and she laid him in a manger. And she rejoiced in her motherhood and commenced to hum to him and to sing and to chant lullabies to put him to sleep. And she gave him sustenance and comfort and spent much of the day and most of the night hugging him and minding him because he was her firstborn. And the child looked back at her and hummed and sang and made small gurgling childish noises. and she rejoiced even the more that he did not whinge and cry and cry his guts out, as most children do. And Joseph rejoiced even more again, because Joseph was a man and would not be expected to put up with the whinging and mewling and puking and screaming of babies. And some short time after that, when King Herod discovered that the so-called wise men from the east had fooled him and had gone their own way without informing him of where the infant Jesus lay, he ordered and decreed that every male child under 2 years of age in the vicinity of Bethlehem should be put to death. And the soldier zapped through the town, ripped the children from the mother's arms, or swept them from where they slept, or from where they played, and they hacked the heads off some of them, and chopped the legs off others, and extracted the nails from the fingers of yet more, just for the fun of it, although the more humane of them drove their stakes through the children's hearts, so as to get it over more quickly. They did it because they were soldiers of the emperor, and they were just obeying orders, as soldiers of the emperor do, and just because there was a lot of big fat money going to the corpse of every child, no matter what weight they were. But by this time, the baby Jesus and his mother and Joseph were safe and sound in Egypt. It hadn't been that difficult for them to escape, since Jesus was always a good child and had never cried, nor bawled, nor whinged. But when the souls of the dead innocent babies left their bodies, they sailed through the air to whatever place the souls of dead innocent babies go who have been murdered without mercy. But as they floated through the air, one of them looked down at the infant Jesus, and he showed them his smashed skull and his bloodied hands and his extracted nails, and his little soul that had never been allowed to grow, and his pure undefiled body that had never been, had the opportunity to contemplate sin. And his spirit cried aloud to Jesus, "This is all your fault." And the infant Jesus looked up at him from the straw in his manger, and his eyes filled up with tears. And that was the very first time that Jesus wept.
That's another short business story.
Not quite as terrible. It's called, from the Old Testament, just a balancing, the only true reason why Cain killed his brother Abel. Some of you might remember. And one evening, when Abel was about to go out to a dance, he came down the stairs. Cain was sitting at the table, scratching his locks and generally minding his own business. "What's up? Where are you going?" he asked, for the sake of saying something or anything at all. "It's none of your fucking business," Abel said, trying to prevent his nose from taking off into the air. "Who the fuck are you, you fucking fucker, asking me where the fuck am I going? As I'm at it, why the fuck are you wearing my fucking purple fucking book at that time?" "Because it was lying in the heap on the floor, through which you jump every morning. You missed it, and I thought, as you weren't wearing it, it would be perhaps alright or even okay." "Well, it's not fucking okay. And didn't I tell you not to lay a fucking hand on my fucking things belonging to me a fucking again?" "Well, you did, of course, but so what? And what is that to me? It's not as if you're going to do anything about it, is it now?" Cain reached for the big red knife on the kitchen table and without pausing to adjust his aim, stuck it viciously into his brother's neck. He made sure that he would never again wear his purple polka dot tie as he slashed it through the middle as he pulled the knife out of his throat. It was covered in blood, anyway.